Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. And at this point in our Monday Night War timeline, Shawn Michaels was telling us a lie, Bret Hart was being screwed, and Nitro main events were filled with running DQs. This is so great, I can reuse this intro for every quarter in 1997.
I'm G. John Chase, and I still haven't been watching any wrestling, and I've still been concentrating my entire life on Batman, whether it's the movies or the game.
I'm Batman!
I'm Carl Jones, a man who has more hair on his back than Miguel Perez, a man whose word is reliable as a Shawn Michaels diagnosis, and the last time I saw something as heavily papered as the Royal Rumble in 1997, I was experimenting at college.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. I've been prayed three times in my entire life. Once in 97 when Shawn had his knee and he came back. Once in 98 when Shawn did his back and he returned again. And this past week I've prayed for the return of Jon Snow. Jon Snow will be resurrected when Lady Melisandre fucks him on his funeral fire.
This is the panel for the 45th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us break down the first quarter of 1997 in the Monday Night War next. Welcome to the 45th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
I wear hockey pants.
Carl Jones.
What's that, Sonny Jim?
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Oh, my balls are sweaty today, boys. Jeans was a bad idea.
We are in the middle of what is actually probably going to be a heat wave by the time this airs, to bring you the latest installment of our History of the Monday Night War timeline. We've been doing these for the last few months, bit by bit. If you haven't heard the previous ones, you can go back and listen to them in the archives by searching for Squared Circle Gazette Radio on iTunes or visiting squaredcirclegazette.podbean.com. We are back today for the first quarter of 1997, which is where we left off. As always, we have notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters at the time from Dave Meltzer, who always has many interesting inside notes in the Observers that obviously we weren't necessarily privy to at the time. A lot of these shows that we've done so far have been really good for kind of bashing misconceptions or even just adding little tidbits of information that we may not have known previously. So we're going to kick off with January 6th Nitro. We have the Horseman drama continuing with Deborah and Woman going at each other. And the whole story with Jeff Jarrett trying to get in the Four Horsemen. Rey Mysterio pins Psychosis in a good match here. The NWO attacks the Giant in the main angle. Hogan laying him out with chair shot after chair shot. They gloated at the announcer's desk. Sting comes down, leaves his bat in the ring. Hogan sends Vincent to use the bat on the Giant. Giant rises from the dead and uses the bat to kind of ward off the NWO. But this ties into the biggest story that started last year of, at this point, we still don't know which side Sting is on.
And is this after Jarrett... Giants won World War III.
It's won World War III. They've just turned him back babyface at the end of last year.
This was the start of the cycle for Paul White.
I believe there were four turns, actually, in 1996 for the Giant. I might be wrong, might be more, but there were four that we recorded anyway. Meanwhile, on Raw, countering this, Bret Hart versus Vader, with Bret Hart losing after a Stone Cold Stunner outside the ring. Sid powerbombs Pete Lothario on a table backstage in the main angle on the show to try and heat up the rematch. Sid and Shawn at the Alamo Dome at the Royal Rumble.
Pete being Jose's son.
Of course, yeah. Or Hose B, as Jerry Lawler called him, I think, once on one of these shows.
I was shocked myself how strong... semi-strong Vader was. I mean, for a guy they never seemed to want to push, really, or go all out with, he got wins. You wouldn't expect him to get wins,
especially in this month.
Yeah, it's funny, I mentioned this to you, I believe it was yesterday, Liam, about how peculiar I found it that Vader would get this win over Bret on TV, and then obviously we would see going into the Rumble another strong win from him. It just seemed almost that sort of bizarre treatment of Vader. You think of his debut in the company, where they don't really do much with him outside of that Yokozuna feud. They put him in the King of the Ring, which he doesn't win. He then becomes the number one contender at SummerSlam and doesn't win. There's almost sort of this stop-start thing where Vince almost wants to try and invest in him because he prized him away from WCW. He needs better heels, frankly. But then it's Vince. He looks at Vader and thinks, he's fat, what am I doing? Let's go back to the drawing board. So it's just all just very strange, very stop-start treatment of Vader just continuing.
I kind of look at this like he's almost like the 97 version of Big Show today, where he's a guy who they protect and give wins to, but only as a higher card utility guy, just to for the position like he'll be in as we'll come to Final Four and stuff like that going down the line. Maybe in current terms we can quantify it like that, but I don't know, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty interesting parallel. I think that in terms of the way they use him going forward, I think that's absolutely accurate. They were giving wins against guys they felt safe giving him wins against, but ultimately he was there. They were keeping him credible for the times they would need to have Vader lose.
I will say, just as a side bit as well, I found the treatment of Bret equally strange at this point. you know, because obviously we know what the original plan was for Mania, and I'm sure we'll get to that in greater
detail.
It's still
the plan
right now. Which it's still the plan, and yet he's been back in the company 2 months, and he's already got a couple of high profile losses to Sid at its time the month before, then this job to Vader here, and it struck me as odd even as a youngster seeing Brett treated that way, because you didn't see Brett lose very often.
Results here for the first Monday Night Battle of 1997. Nitro with a 3.4 to Raw's 2.1, so very much symbolic of the time. We were talking about this. This is pretty much where the ratings were sitting for the previous 3 months. The peak for either show was actually Ray versus Psychosis at 4.0, interestingly enough. There have been a ton of rumours this week about Harlem Heat going to the WWF, but based on what I'm hearing, says Meltzer, the WWF has so much committed to guys already under long-term contracts with guaranteed money that they're second-guessing a lot of the deals already. Obviously the name Mark Henry comes to mind when we talk about this, but when we were talking about Bret Hart just a second ago in terms of that treatment, this actually might tie in a little bit here in terms of, they pretty much bet the farm on Bret. They'd spent so much money to get him, and the initial results past that first week, as we mentioned on the last time we visited this topic, the ratings weren't there immediately, and the buy rate for its time was one of the worst of the year, if not the worst.
One of the things that really stuck out when we re-watching the WWF portion of this quarter we're going to talk about was there did seem a lot more 50-50 booking, as we call it today, with the top guy. Sid himself went over Brett and Shawn in the space of like a month, maybe looking to get value out of Brett. Honestly, didn't strike me in the face like it was remorse.
On the topic of Sid there as well, again, this is someone who's being put in a high-profile position, who, prior to him coming back in the summer of 96, he hadn't been treated particularly strong when he was a member of the Million Dollar Corporation or anything like that, so it just, again, to me, ties in with this notion of Vince sort of not really being fully committed to anything in particular, because he's not really sure in himself as to the direction going forward.
Moving along, January 13th, Nitro at the Superdome in New Orleans. It was the first Nitro ever to top 10,000 people in the building at 10,034, and the first pro wrestling event to top 10,000 and do six figures in New Orleans, dating back 10 years to the final year of Bill Watts' promotion. Some key notes throughout this show here. Sting does the death drop on Jim Duggan, much to my delight. Still, again, playing that whole we don't know whose side he's on. The big angle here, DDP versus Mark Starr. Not that necessarily, but after the match, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash come out, offer DDP the shirt. This is the angle that they've been teasing it for months. Finally, DDP puts the shirt on, pulls Scott Hall in, hits the diamond cutter. Nash goes to hit him, pulls the rope down. Nash takes a bump. DDP runs off through the crowd. This is the birth of DDP, pretty much as a top guy.
For all the hate that DDP gets in some quarters, and I'm always much kinder to him than I think a lot of people are, you look at the reaction he gets. Is it sort of forced a little bit, almost, in the way that they, he does have connections, and that's how they sort of pick him out for someone to be in a more privileged position. But the live crowds are absolutely with it. DDP does get over, regardless of what anyone says. You talk about New Orleans and how dead it had been as a territory since Watts had gone out of business, since the economy had pretty much gone belly up through the oil crash and all that sort of thing. You know, to use an example, Flair, Steamboat and the lauded three-match series that we talk about in 89 didn't draw numbers like that drew for a TV show.
Yeah,
I mean, that whole angle with DDP is just fantastic when you watch it. I mean, the crowd really popped for it. And I think it's a mixture. Yeah, obviously, DDP had his connections, and a lot of other people in wrestling have their connections as well. It's the angle is fantastic. It was a mixture of, like, you know, the talents of DDP, how over, obviously, the NWO was, and just how they built it up as well. When we talk about like stars of WCW, as in their own stars, not just someone that they scammed from the WWF, you know, there's only like a handful of them. And you know, you mentioned the Stings, Ric Flair's like a fair choice, even though he worked in WWF. Goldberg's like the main one that everyone says, and just the general build that DDP had over time to actually become a star. Okay, he wasn't the biggest drawing star like Goldberg, but I think his rise is very notable, particularly at this point.
This, for me, highlights one of my biggest frustrations with WCW at this period.
Really?
They had so many ready-made stars in that company, which was driving it along, but it was crying out to create new stars, and DDP showed... nothing against DDP, you know, his finish is great and his misses his heart, but I would never describe him as a great, but he got over, and they had so many stars who you could beat to make a young star, and there was absolutely no reason not to do that over the next 3 years, other than none of the guys wanted to be that guy, apart from Savage, who, fair play to him, said, I'm going to help Paige kind of thing. The biggest frustration of this period is there's no reason for not making stars, and Paige proves you could.
Just again, we're still on this Nitro here. Throughout the show, this is very interesting. Hogan and Giant is the scheduled main event. This was just a TNT ratings ploy to artificially build up ratings for the debut of Robin Hood that followed. Nitro ended with a match 1 minute in progress, and it was 1 minute of stalling. They taped a 3 minute match live in the building, but they said, if you stay tuned to Robin Hood, we'll play the match through the commercials. So they spread the 3 minute match over the course of 45 minutes to make it look like it was this long epic match. Of course, it ended with a DQ and a bunch of run-ins. We received a bunch of complaining phone calls to the Observer and faxes, which takes you back, about the sleazy method TNT used to artificially spike the ratings of Robin Hood and work the wrestling fans.
Well, in principle, I haven't got a problem with that, but the fact is, you do it with your main event of your next pay-per-view like days away. Fucking stupid.
Over on Raw, meanwhile, on January 13th, we pretty much just get Sid and Shawn promos to hype the Rumble, a Undertaker versus Crush main event.
Ugh.
With the Nation of Domination attacking Ahmed Johnson, Vader attacking the Undertaker to set up that match for the Rumble as well. So pretty much all Rumble build here. Nitro does a 3.4 to Raw's 2.3, again seemingly typical, but Raw actually opens stronger with a 2.4 to Nitro's 2.2. However, Nitro took the lead with a 3.1 to a 2.4 when Guerrero and Malenko was head up against the Undertaker and Crush. Meltzer adds, so much for the idea that the casual fans are into big guys and not good matches. Okay. Unfortunately, Vince wouldn't get that message over the next 3 months.
And then would quickly forget it in later years. I think, again, that sort of harks back a bit to Kieran's point there about sort of future stars or there being individuals within the company who fans are interested in and who fans will stick with, who we would see in later years aren't elevated to the positions they need to be for the company going forward.
After Nitro, there was a brawl where Kevin Sullivan punched Chris Benoit twice at about 12:30 a.m. at High Toppers, a bar near the Superdome, and they had a major pull-apart brawl after Benoit was making out with Nancy. This is similar to the Pillman deal in that the only ones in on it are Kevin, Nancy, Chris, Bischoff, and a few others, but they're trying to pass it off to the boys as legit since most of the wrestlers were there. Because of the Pillman deal, almost none of the wrestlers buy this, but there were a few there who thought it was legit. There were actually only a few people at the bar that weren't WCW personnel, so this is all designed towards working the wrestlers,
because that's where the money is.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
We'll see how that one plays out.
Yeah. As of January 14th, a total of 28,800 tickets had been sold for the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome. WWF officials are crossing their fingers that a huge walk-up will take place on the day of the show. It's the most extensive local promotion ever, combining the top radio and television stations in the market with a local newspaper, along with literally millions of discount coupons throughout Southeast Texas on cans of Dr. Pepper and all the Taco Bells. In addition, the pay-per-view is being blacked out throughout Southeast Texas, and there are over 7,000 free tickets out with local stations and businesses already. The Alamo Dome seats 71,000. I've got 28,800 so far, and we're days away from the show.
Yeah, and those yahoos on WWF TV still can't find a ticket or find their way to the Alamo Dome. Strange.
Yeah, that is peculiar.
You have to question just how big this promotional spree really is.
The February pay-per-view will be called the Final Four, and will be headlined, and this is the plan at this point, by a Four Corners match with Sid, Shawn, Bret, and Austin. We'll see how that plays out. Yeah. January 19th, we move to the Royal Rumble. 60,525 is the number they managed to get in the building. Only 48,014 of them paid to get in, however. But still, this is the second largest paid attendance in the history of pro wrestling in the United States at this point. Shawn Michaels wins the WWF Championship from Sid.
Shawn said it was 71,000.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Shawn wouldn't lie.
Shawn wouldn't lie.
Honest Shawn.
Honest Shawn.
Straight up Shawn.
Thank God they're
shooting up Shawn.
I would say thank God they took the belt off Sid, but we'll see where that goes. At this point, I was so depressed when Sid won the belt in the first place. Thank God Shawn got it back here. Other news, Steve Austin wins the Royal Rumble in a last-minute decision. Bret Hart was supposed to win this match, but Vince thought that too many people knew, so they changed it to Austin with the idea that Bret was going to get the WrestleMania match with Shawn. That was still the plan at this point.
Somewhere at that point, Lex Luger's thinking to himself, now you know how I felt, Bret.
Yeah, but see, in the long run, this worked out for the best. Because it just all played into the Steve and Bret stuff, which is just, no, it's magic. Magic, folks.
Oh, I think it's an excellent bit of booking. Absolutely fantastic.
They obviously had a lot of faith in Austin at this point already. He was obviously going to be in the Final Four match that was already booked. Yeah, he was, you know, booked as the star of the Rumble. So
it is like Austin and Bret that come out as the big deals in that match. I mean, in fairness, the rest of participants was very bad. I mean, 96 was worse, but Austin's individual performance of him. I think he comes in very early on, doesn't
five.
He? Yeah, and he's just doing the whole thing where he's eliminating people one by one, and he's sitting on the corner of the ring, and he's looking at that imaginary watch of his that reappears in 2001. And all I can remember is actually being surprised by the finish of it, with and actually being kind of slightly confused and annoyed as a Bret Hart fan that he was screwed over by Austin. But obviously, I mean, at that time, with the plans being, obviously, they're going for Bret Shawn at WrestleMania, this isn't good work by them. But obviously, it all kind of worked out in the end, because obviously more of a shitstorm happens, and it turns out that having Austin win the Rumble was a secret blessing.
But you'd say, even if they were still going with the original plan, it was important in making Austin a focal point, even still, because, you know, he gets the sort of the diesel run that we'd seen a few years earlier with Nash, where he's tossing guys out left, right and centre. An example of the crowd gravitating towards him as well, there's a spot in that Rumble match where he's all alone in the ring. I think it might have been after he's eliminated the real Double J, so that might have had something to do with it as well, perhaps. Where the crowd just sort of just gradually, you just hear this cheer build up for him. And then in classic Steve Austin fashion, he sort of flips them all off and just no-sells it, completely committed to the heel sign. But at least it was still that commitment to Austin. So I think that's why I'd still give it praise, even if it was sort of meshed up the way that they ultimately got to their end destination.
He'd lost to Bret, but the association with Bret had raised his profile, but he'd done nothing, so he needed the focus. Even if there was no plan that he'd become the super face, it was just to get him in the heat as a heel with heat. It was... he needed it, and it was good. What I find interesting about this Rumble is, after the first, I think, 20 entrants bar Austin are pretty forgettable, but I think like the last 8 are like Austin, Bret, Taker,
Vader's in there,
Vader,
Diesel
Rocky
2,
yeah, Kane as Diesel 2,
Mankind, Terry Funk
was Funk there as well. It's so, yeah, so that it's for years to come, so, that's just very interesting.
Yeah, it is, actually, when I think about it.
When Jerry Lawler in the Rumble, he's a surprise entrance. Surprise entrance. He starts off and goes, he takes a king, and he gets up, I think, gets in the ring, gets eliminated straight away by Bret, sits back down and goes, to know a king. And then later in the Rumble, he simply forgets that he was actually in the match himself.
That's awesome.
0.7 buy rate for 175,000 buyers, a big drop from the previous year, which did a 1.0 buy rate. So numbers are not really looking in their favour, as much as we were talking about momentum before. The next night, January 20th, Nitro, the all-time WCW attendance record at this point for 17,000 plus fans in Chicago at the United Center, and an all-time single event merchandise record with nearly $107,000. Randy Savage returns after having been away since Halloween Havoc, and holds the show hostage to start the show. Sting comes down with a baseball bat. They do the angle where he's hands him the bat, turns his back, but they leave together as a unit. Benoit and Sullivan have another brawl in the bathroom. Scott Hall over Booker T and Lex Luger over Stevie Ray are the final two matches, and we have a Hogan giant pull apart to close the show. Over on Raw, Meltzer says the best draw in a long time. Bret Hart quits the company at the very start of the show. Monsoon then announces the final four-way match, gets the title shot at WrestleMania due to the controversy between Vader, Taker, Austin and Bret. Austin comes out to some awesome mic work on Monsoon. Bret comes out from the crowd for a great brawl after the Taker-Austin match and a Vader run-in. Meltzer says for the second straight night it was the Steve Austin show, and he's very close to being, if not is, the premier all-around performer in the country right now.
It's the first, well, not the first real season, because you see it at the Rumble, but it's one of the first sort of prominent Bret the Crybaby promos, and he walks out through the crowd, and then as Steve Austin, that Raw was absolutely the Steve Austin show, and he is absolutely fantastic as a single performance. I know I'm completely biased when it comes to Steve Austin.
Bret, all you've done since you've come back is nothing but cry.
And the burial of Monsoon, you know, I've got all the respect in the world for Gorilla Monsoon, but at this point he had no business being on TV.
Nitro, however, did a 3.7 towards 2.2. The rating was a major cause of concern for both the WWF and the USA Network, and they've talked about going live as frequently as the schedule permits and increasing the show to 2 hours from now on. The cost of doing a show of that type would run to the six figures weekly, so currently it's just an interesting question of how the bill will be split between USA and the WWF.
If I can just ask quickly there, that Raw number, is that down on the previous weeks?
Up. Oh, wait, no, sorry, it's down.
It's down, so that, you know, just to show how cold the company is, coming off that Royal Rumble, which, you know, you've got the new champion in Shawn, you've got the controversy with Austin.
The traditional post-pay-per-view bump.
The traditional post-pay-per-view bump. Coming off what is the second most important pay-per-view in the company, and the number goes down. And you contrast that with Nitro and the record at the United Center, the merchandise sales, you know, the return of Savage, and it just seems that, you know, WWF just cannot get any traction.
The irony, of course, to all this is the fact that the WWF television ratings aren't strong. I mean, they've been struggling for a while now, but the house show business is the best it's been in years, and this was something we were talking about for last year, the whether or not Sean's run can actually truly be defined as a failure. Because the funny thing here is, in 1995, while Diesel was the worst drawing champion in company history up to this point, that was judged on the house shows. At the time, Raw ratings, especially in the summer of 95, were actually through the roof. We talked about that in the very beginning of this series, that Raw ratings were huge, but it didn't matter because it wasn't an important part of the business then. The house show business was, and that was in the tank. Here, Shawn Michaels has on the house shows is doing the best business WWF's done for 5 years, but now the business is all about ratings, and it's got to be crippling for Shawn that he was hearing all this for so long about how the houses are down. He gets the houses up to a certain point, but no one really gives a shit about that anymore because it's now about ratings.
It is bizarre, and I think it all just boils down to the wider perception outside of wrestling, isn't it? About, you know, what's the hot company, what's the number two company, and they get stuck in this sort of mind warp about the ratings. You know, all the thinking becomes so short term, and they get so sort of tunnel visioned over it. I think it just speaks to panic within the WWF, obviously coming off a loss making year the year before. And to some extent, the paranoia of WCW, even though they're winning, it's that desperation to stay ahead, because we can't give the impression at any point that we're falling back.
This is why WCW had, in my opinion, had the big advantage and the big jump at the start. They were ahead in the perception game. They had a nice looking product. They had the 2 hours and it was live. It's a hotter, snappier, more contemporary looking show, and they've got the bigger perceived stars from in the wrestling world at the time,
and the hottest angle.
Yeah, certainly a great number, and absolutely the hottest angle, which was more than anything else different from what had happened in the past, as we said when we started this off.
Savage's new contract was for a limited amount of dates and $1 million per year. WCW was justifying the deal after they'd originally lowballed Savage because they were going to lose the Slim Jim sponsorship without him, and that brings in $500,000 per year by itself. Due to the favored nations clause, Hall and Nash get given raises to $900,000 a year. So they're playing the game pretty well at this point. January 21st, WCW Clash. Luger versus Scott Hall main events. Nothing else of note really on this show, other than the fact that they did a 3.5 rating, which is fairly good, but way down from last year's 4.5, with Hogan Savage versus Flair in the giant main event. January 26th, we move to Sold Out.
Yeah! Love the show.
It came off to outsiders as the brainchild of someone intoxicated by his own success to the point of all perspective being lost, and was the single worst pay-per-view show in the history of wrestling, says Dave Meltzer. There has never been a show with such poor announcing and outside skits, and combined with a bad wrestling, lack of heat, and bad atmosphere, made it the worst.
Loser.
Mexican Jumping Bean, Eddie Guerrero.
This show is just fucking the NWO beauty pageant needs to be mentioned here.
Yeah. It's a good job that there was a toilet bowl readily on hand, because this card was full of shit.
I'll say.
Oh, go on.
I'm not going to defend it because it was fucking because atrocious.
Trial,
but what I'll say is, as a concept in the view to a bigger NWO angle, I can understand it, but it was just, it wasn't perceived like that. It was perceived like Bischoff looking to experiment with a separate brand.
Of course.
For me, if this was like they'd won their own show and it was them lording up themselves, but at the end of it, say you had like a guy, an underdog, say like a Benoit, beating like Hogan non-title or something like that, something that really shits on the NWO and pisses them off and gets some shine back for WCW in the faces, I think there's value to it. But I mean, the way this was put together is just nauseating bullshit. So.
Yeah, well, they kind of tried to do what you implied there with the whole Eddie Guerrero beat Six in the ladder match, which is out of Nick Patrick's hands. The Steiners beat the Outsiders for the tag belts, of course. Win comes in quotes, and we'll get to that on Nitro the next night. But ultimately, it ends with Hogan and the Giant in a fucking terrible main event.
Yeah, and it's how the show ends is how people tend to remember things. You know, with this show or any other show, it ends with the Giant flat on his back, the NWO celebrating, Hogan's got the belt, so you think all that build up. And bearing in mind, you're coming off the start of the show where they're arriving in
garbage lorries, I guess.
Yeah, they're arriving in garbage men. Yeah, they may as well have had the WCW guys travelling those the way they were treated on the show. So they're blown off as second rate. Even if they're getting wins, they're sort of being buried in the process with the entrances and that sort of thing. You've got Bischoff and DiBiase on commentary also burying them just to hammer the point home. And then it ends with Hogan coming out victorious. So, to Kieran's point, if it ended with a babyface getting the shine and sort of, you know, Bischoff throws a temper tantrum on commentary and that sort of thing, whilst I'm not going to say that the show was great, it at least served a purpose, ultimately, in advancing something. But this show may as well have just never happened. Because of how it ends. Yeah.
Yeah, no, actually, I really like Kieran's idea, actually. I think that if it was someone like a Benoit, someone like that, that just that kind of image at the end where they're expecting, like, without kind of burying him too much, expecting, like, it might be a whitewash, like, it's like an easy victory for Hogan, and he comes back and actually wins. And it could be the whole thing where he's celebrating, WCW guys come in, they're celebrating with him, and Bischoff's just like, just cut the fucking cameras right now, just cut it now, like, we don't want to see this guy's image on there. But even if it wasn't someone new, even if it was something like a Ric Flair or someone, just someone on the WCW side coming out on top, it would have worked.
Yeah, it's any kind of narrative function, but as you say, this show had no, when it was over, there was absolutely no point in it whatsoever.
It was an absolute cockfest, and it was just for NWO. I mean, like the whole beauty pageant thing
those girls aren't much to look at, but to say that, Jesus. Oh,
but it's just the fact that, you know,
Jeff Katz sucks.
My issue with the show production value outside of the, you know, the moms in the beauty pageant with their little high waisted mom jeans, which have somehow come back into fashion recently.
See, you're wearing a pair today, actually.
Well, I've got a lot to hold in. It kind of showed up, the NWO angle in itself, because when the NWO is just concentrated to a small group of people, a small group that are black and white inside this colourful world and so on, they look alternative. Once everything is black and white, it just looks shit. That's what it looks. It looks shit. It looks cheap. It stopped making the NWO gimmick special.
As a matter of fact, Dave Meltzer here with another great quote. The show is about as much fun to watch as 3 hours of somebody masturbating, and in fact, I'm not sure that isn't what we were watching. In terms of how this did, 5,000 fans in the building, and 0.47 for 117,000 buys, half of what Starrcade did the month before. So this is seen as a massive failure within the company. We move on to the next night, January 27th, Nitro. WCW wanted Roddy Piper on this show, but since everything's done at the last second, Piper had other commitments and wasn't there. The Steins have to give the belts back and look like completely impotent babyfaces in the process. Hogan, the giant main event, once again, and once again, it goes 3 minutes before a running DQ. But Lex Luger makes the save, so it's all okay. Over on Raw, Vader and Mankind lose to the Godwins by countout in the main event. Peculiar choice. Highlight is a promo segment with Sean, Brett, Taker, and Austin, with Brett saying he wants Sean to do whatever he has to do to come out of the Thursday Raw Thursday as champion because he wants to beat him at WrestleMania. Again, can't emphasize, that's still the plan at this point. Nitro does a 3.6, divorce 2.2, so no surprises there. A couple of injury notes from this week. Arn Anderson is out of action with a hand injury, which explains why he wasn't at Nitro. Don't have details on it other than it is serious, and he's not expected back in the ring that quickly, which is likely to necessitate putting Jeff Jarrett in the Horseman, at least temporarily. More on that later. Rey Mysterio Jr. went to the doctor this past week and was told he needs major surgery, which would keep him out 4 to 6 months. Instead, he's back working, wearing a heavy knee brace, because he's 22 and that's how 22-year-olds think. The long-term inevitability is now starting with Mysterio, however. It would actually, I believe it would take him like a full year before he got that surgery, because he was there until like sold out 98, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he was pretty much running a regular schedule with WCW up until they did the injury angle with Jericho.
Yeah. Moving ahead to Raw, February 3rd, the original plan due to sweeps is that the USA Network wanted the WWF to air the entire Royal Rumble on the one-hour show. The reason is that the highest rated pro wrestling show ever in the history of the USA Network was the 88 Royal Rumble, the original, which did an 8.2 rating. However, after agreeing to air the Rumble, request and viewers' choice protested, so they just aired 30-second clips of the match. USA instead then decided that they wanted to do a 2-hour show, so the decision was made to turn the January 31st house show in the Toronto Sky Dome into a Raw television taping. As a result, they had 25,628 fans in attendance. The show was pretty poorly lit and the crowd wasn't well mic'd. Just a real kind of weird, sloppy show. Again, we're seeing that pattern here, though, of the networks are using these shows with the momentum they both have to kind of leverage it for their own ends here. The main aspect of this show is the great Shawn Michaels Bret Hart angle, where again, since they're wrestling at WrestleMania at this point, Bret and Shawn have the belt between them, Sean goes to pick it up, Brett puts his foot on it, Brett picks it up, goes to give it to Sean, and then as Sean goes to get it, he just drops it on the mat and gives him the finger, which is just great in Canada. Sean gets some booze and he doesn't seem to like it that much.
Brett's great in this moment when I was like, watching, awesome. I was catching the butt end of that while last night when you guys were watching it.
Like, that is a great individual segment. Absolutely love it, and forgotten about it until watching it recently. But the company, in many respects, just sort of can't catch a break. You'd think, you know, big venue, Sky Dome in Toronto, 25,000 people. You know, yes, we know what the Sky Dome can hold, and the fact that it's, you know, less than half full, effectively. But you mentioned about the way it's lit and the way it comes across, and that sort of that production value element of things that was so great for WCW. At this point, the WF just looks so second rate, and when the audience aren't mic'd properly and they haven't got the lighting planned as they would have if they'd had more preparation for the show.
The cameras didn't look as good.
The cameras don't look, it looks grainy. It just comes off as second best, as they clearly were at the time.
Over on Nitro, they do a show-long tease for Hogan versus Piper tonight. But of course it doesn't happen. Piper brings his son out and says he wasn't accepting the match. Hogan then started running him down in front of his son, and Hogan, who actually in the opening segment sucked balls, did a great job here. Eventually Piper put his son out the ring and began brawling with Hogan, accepting the match for Super Brawl. The Debra McMichael Nancy Sullivan angle, which has been going on for a few weeks, has now been dropped in favour of both of them versus Jacqueline. Surprisingly enough, not a lot of people in the company were happy about it, because they felt the Debra woman stuff was some of the best stuff going on Nitro in January. I don't know if that's a thought echoed around this table.
It sure as shit is not.
I will second that motion.
Whilst it wasn't obviously the best angle going in WCW due to NWO, or even anywhere probably near the top five, in fairness, at that point, was that the only storyline that the Four Horsemen are actually in?
Well, I think the Benoit Sullivan deal, so
There's the Benoit Sullivan sort of workshop, and there's the Jeff Jarrett, I can be the horseman that goes all night long.
Yeah, keep in mind, Flair is injured at this time. He's not around, and Arn is injured too. So basically, it's just the three of them.
That's why they had the women's angle, I guess. I guess it was add something to it, whether you rate it or not. I mean, there was some sort of natural conflict there.
Yeah, they didn't like each other in real life too. Yeah, that might have played some part, who knows.
Yeah, wanted to use it.
The margin of WCW's victory was cut noticeably. We mentioned this was a two-hour show versus two-hour show. Cut noticeably from previous week, as Nitro only did a 3.0 to Raw's 2.6. So very interesting there. Things have really, I mean, in both directions, both shot up closer to the mean average, if you like. Dennis Rodman's people told WCW that he had a $500,000 offer to do WrestleMania and be in Goldust's corner to set up the two as a tag team for SummerSlam. Since he'd previously worked for WCW at the Bash of the Beach, Rodman gave them the opportunity to match the offer. So obviously this will become a bigger story later in this quarter. The Westminster Dog Show replaces Raw this week, so Nitro's unopposed. DDP comes out and challenges anybody to do whatever they wanted to him. Dave Meltzer's words, not mine. Sting and Randy Savage come out, and again they do the baseball bat gimmick with DDP, where they're hitting the chair while Paige is sitting in it, and it appears that Paige is on their team too. Kevin Sullivan delivered one of the nuttiest interviews in wrestling history. Sullivan talked about having a phone call with he and Nancy's best friend Paul Lee, talked about Jim Barnett because apparently Sullivan is of the belief that Barnett is secretly behind the scenes manipulating everything in WCW, and even more nonsense. Kevin and Nancy are trying so hard to make everybody believe they're now separated that they actually are, although behind the scenes they're political allies, while in front of all the wrestlers they're not on speaking terms. Bizarre Kevin Sullivan promo, just referencing all this stuff that nobody gets.
What was Sullivan's position in this company?
He was a bucker.
That'll explain it, because I just never had a slightest bit of interest in Kevin Sullivan. He was just a crazy little midget, taking up airtime, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I just, no time for Sullivan at this point.
He always walked around like he needed a shit.
He had big legs.
Yeah.
Big, strong, powerful legs.
Have that bow-legged thing.
he looked like he lost his donkey. Yeah.
His day's been and gone, and he's probably best if he's not there taking up TV time, but let's just watch that hilarity continue.
This was epitomised WCW with these, obviously, you know, I was a massive WF mark at the time, but what turned me off WCW was, I love the, you know, what was the computer game? It was WCW versus the World, and I had DX Stable
with Malenko at the helm.
Malenko, I can't remember who else, but it was all young guys, you know, that's what I think it was probably from the, as a football fan, Carl, from Euro 96, when like the Dutch team with all their young Ajax stars and, you know, creating new stars. And I think, you know, the myth of the McMyth of Vince being able to create, you know, talent, that's appealed to me. And in WCW, you had Sullivan and Piper. It just wasn't progressive. It really frustrated me. And
the one thing I would say, at least, is that the Sullivan Nancy program, if you want to call it that, at least does get Benoit time at a point where well, we know that pans out ultimately, but at least it gives it Benoit a more prominent role, when at the time, without Anderson, without Flair, with the NWO heavy obsession, he could have quite easily just been lost and swallowed up by something and just disappeared.
Well, I think that this is, although yeah, I agree with you in that respect, I think this is, it kind of sums up WCW. Everyone in their, you know, the undercard in their isolated little pockets doing their little things, but in the long term, it's so irrelevant, because it just kept going around in circles, people in their little pockets, making no impact on the main event scene, and it was frustrating for me. So.
But at this time, that hasn't necessarily worn out its welcome. I think that's the key reason for why this is working right now for WCW.
Just a question. What was the rating for this unopposed Nitro?
The unopposed Nitro did a 3.8.
Because Roar had gone to the dogs.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's because listening to like the previous numbers you've given, the last few weeks, and if I remember some of the numbers that you did at the end of 96, the numbers, besides just a 0.1 here and there, have pretty much been the same now for a good few weeks.
Correct,
so it's like
yeah,
a couple months now. They've just got this fixed number now, and they don't seem to be growing anymore. And I mean, here, even when Roar is off air for a week, they only gain roughly about 500,000.
Hogan and Piper promo to end the show. Piper tried to make a crack at Hogan that he would fit in San Francisco, which is where the match at Super Brawl is, which is silly because Piper is the face and the match is in San Francisco. Very funny there. The biggest news on February 10th, however, isn't really anything that happens on this Nitro. It's the fact that the WWF and the USA Network officially confirmed that a 2-hour, generally live Monday Night Raw will become a fixture starting next week. So now it is 2 hours head-to-head, no more lead-ins, no more 1-hour advantage for either side. Meltzer adds, I don't know what the end result of the head-to-head 2-hour battles will be, as far as the ultimate winner and loser. I do believe the costs on the personal lives and sanity of those in the thick of the battle will be more than anyone has considered up to this point. The WCW Nitro on February 10th showed key people self-destructing, either from the pressure or lack of perspective already. The show was totally devoid of direction, and it was obvious by one interview after another going nowhere that nobody has a clue where they're going. Some people have some nasty habits that they better get in check, or far bigger problems than losing in the ratings are ahead.
How prophetic was Big Dave there?
he's had a few of these prophetic moments, actually, in the Observers at the time. Speaking of personal issues and people cracking, we moved to Thursday Raw Thursday on February 13th. Yeah.
Honestly,
what is that?
It's Vince McMahon salesman, you know, to bang it home. It's Thursday. It's Raw on Thursday. So
yeah,
slam it home. That's, don't, you know, remember when the show... When's the show? Thursday, Raw Thursday. It's going to be on fucking Thursday.
Obviously, this is because of the dog show that Raw got preempted to Thursday this week.
Which isn't the NWO beauty pageant, by the way.
Obviously, the big story here, Shawn Michaels vacates the WWF Championship, citing a knee injury so bad that even reconstructive surgery may not be able to repair the damage. A teary-eyed Michaels, whose problem in the promo was clearly not a knee injury, said farewell to the WWF in a classic interview. It only wound up, of course, with noted orthopedic surgeon Dr. Jim Andrews saying Michaels' knee injury wouldn't even require surgery at all, and that after 4 to 6 and that after 4 to 6 weeks of rehab, he may be able to return.
As I said, I did pray for it, so...
Well, yeah.
Hallelujah!
So you're saying this isn't a case for the Kieran Conspiracy Corner, then?
Ah, well...
Oh, I think it absolutely is.
Obviously, I mean, it goes without saying that Sean was pulling everyone's leg here. Ba-bum-bumf.
Apparently, the WWF higher-ups received word about 6 p.m. the previous night that Michaels was taking time off, as his doctor in San Antonio had told him his knee injury could be career-threatening. Sean was, in fact, supposed to lose the WWF Championship to Sid at this show, so the plan has changed in the last 3 weeks, and he was going to, of course, follow it up in his next high-profile match, having to put Bret Hart over in the now semi-final match at WrestleMania. WrestleMania, consequently, is fucked.
Hang on, are you saying he would have dropped the belt
to Sid? He was supposed to lose the belt to Sid at Thursday Raw Thursday. That was the plan. That's why. Well, I don't know if that was exactly why, but I would certainly imagine that's why Sean left.
Jesus.
He was supposed to lose to Sid.
Then him and Brett was going to be non-title.
The second biggest match on the show behind Taker and Sid. The plan was Sid was going to win the world title anyway.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
It's fucking Mania 8 all over again.
They wanted to go again. If it was just Vince going on the big man kick, it clearly was, considering that was the direction. But the plan was here. Sid is supposed to win.
How many times can we just hark on about the point that Vince is just completely throwing shit at the wall? He's panicking. He doesn't know what to do.
He's just given Sean the belt back three weeks earlier.
I was under the impression it was Sean was pulled the injury angle, so he didn't have to drop the belt to Brett.
I'm absolutely stunned by what I've just heard, frankly.
And I'm in Sean's corner, quite frankly.
And with that in mind,
should have pulled his back then.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, even me, as big of a piece of shit as I think Shawn Michaels is, if I'm him, I'm finding the Texas George Zahorian, and I'm getting a medical note as well.
Of course, as a result of this, the title is now up for grabs in the final four match, which is happening a few days later at the Sunday pay-per-view. The other thing of note here, Rocky Maivia wins the Intercontinental Championship off Hunter Hearst Helmsley in a match where the crowd chants, "Rocky sucks." Aww. Bret Hart versus Vader in the main event, with Bret getting a win over Vader, getting his win back. A 2.3 rating here for Thursday Raw Thursday, a rating that would be considered an absolute disaster had WCW done that number for a clash.
The venue that this was held in looked pretty shitty as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Again, I just want to make that point, because we talk about perception a lot with this, and just the optics of it all just looks so poor for the company. At a time where you can afford so few errors in terms of trying to gain that traction, you could have a great show or a fantastic show, but if it looks like it's in a dump, those optics just play a part and just keep hammering the point home. We're not as good as the other guys.
One day later, big news that will ultimately have impact on WCW and the whole business in general. February 14th, Eric Bischoff meets with TBS and finalizes the plan for TBS to begin its own live 2-hour primetime wrestling show at some point in the not-too-distant future, perhaps as early as the May sweeps. The decision as to what night and when it will start will probably not be made for another couple of weeks, and the idea of doing another show has just come up in the past week or two. The general feeling within WCW was, how the hell are we going to pull this off? This, of course, would become WCW Thunder, and it would take another 11 months. It would take another 11 months for it to debut. But the deal is made here.
I didn't realise it was made so far in advance, to be honest. I almost thought it was like one of those, almost a matter of weeks kind of turnaround. But we talked before about how formulaic the TV was already becoming. I dread to think how bad it would have been if Thunder had been launched any earlier.
It's just, at the moment, it's just kind of plateauing at the moment. So it's surprising that they want to turn around and then add another 2-hour show onto it.
I don't think it's that shocking at all, to be honest. The reason I say that is because, yes, the numbers aren't what we would see, 12 months from this point, 18 months from this point, where they would go through the roof and wrestling would become the part of the cultural mainstream.
Cool again, Drain.
Yeah, absolutely. Whilst it's not at that point yet, it's worth remembering that bordering on fours is a fantastic number for cable television.
Absolutely.
On TNT. And even the 2.3s, 2.4s that Raw is doing, under any other circumstances, for cable TV, that's a fantastic number. And as Liam's already mentioned, we talked about cable companies already using wrestling as a portfolio to boost other things. So I can absolutely see why they would want it. I'm just absolutely bloody relieved that it didn't happen so soon.
You did the tidbit of saying that this was like a pretty big moment in terms of wrestling history. Are you referencing that as in terms of how it personally affected WCW due to putting another show on, and obviously that was a element of affecting it in the future? Or were you talking about the long-term effect of the oversaturation of a product?
All of it. Okay. It's all the exact same. It's all one big fucking cluster. Yeah. I don't see any positive. I don't see what good came of it, because even the money they ended up getting from TBS was minimal.
Well, we had all those great Thunders.
We moved to Sunday night, February 16th, the show we've all been waiting for, Final Four. A 0.5 buy rate for 130,000 buys here. Bret Hart wins the WWF Championship for the fourth time in a very fun four-way match. Actually, really enjoy that match. Nothing else of note at all on this pay-per-view, I should know. Other than, actually, I take that back, China debuts.
Right, we'll go back to the China debut in a minute.
No, we won't.
Because the rest of the show, as you said, isn't great. That main event, That is a strangely enjoyable match because
there's no fucking really good structure to it at all.
There's no structure at all. It's not, in fact, there's no good structure. There's no structure to it at all. It's basically just four guys that just looked at each other from across the ring and just went, well, I guess we're beating the shit out of each other there.
That's caught in the ring.
There's no plan. They're just like, I mean, Vader gets busted open as well, which is absolutely brilliant. He's just like, just bleeding all over the place. Yeah. It was just, I just remember just watching it and just like laughing at the chaos and thinking like, this is actually like really entertaining because it doesn't seem like your usual planned wrestling.
No, I agree. I think that's probably
like, if you know what I mean. Like, yeah, we all know it's all predetermined and everything, but in this kind of moment, it just, you could really like, you know, suspend.
It's a bunch of guys who don't do choreographed bullshit wrestling. I hate to say it in such a condescending way, but these matches, three ways, four ways, became let's come up with so many fucking cool spots and let's see what we can come up with. Whereas this was like, okay, Brett wants to get Austin, but Austin wants to get Brett. They're all fighting for the belt. Let's just fucking go out and do it. And it's so much better. There's so much energy for a show that has none, really. The energy in the crowd, the energy in the match, I'm a huge fan of this one.
I was pleasantly surprised as well, because the steps of like the over-the-top rope or pinfall submission, it was kind of, you know, I'm not a fan of that in principle.
Yeah, a real way to avoid three jobs, you know?
But yeah, in the same respect, you know, you don't want a match where you got three losers coming out. It's my biggest pet peeve of more
main event losers. Yeah,
like with the what's it called, the Elimination Chamber matches, you have five losers or whatever. I just hate that concept. But yeah, so you know, you protected Austin and the other guy, so yeah, it was just a hell of a fun match.
We move to the next night because the 2-hour war begins, and it begins in a rather shocking form for the WWF as Sid wins the WWF title once again. Obviously, you know, the whole point was get the belt to Sid somehow, since that's the plan anyway. The show opened with the Bret Hart Sid title match about to start, but Steve Austin does a run-in going after Bret and clipping Sid's knee. They're about to start the match at the beginning of the second hour, but this time Austin attacked Bret backstage. Finally, they held the match in the final quarter hour of the show with Sid winning the title after Austin's interference. A chair shot to the back of the head here while he's got Sid in the sharpshooter. So Sid, WWF champion, heading into WrestleMania.
God knows what's going on with Sean's mental state. Even if the injury isn't as severe as is made out, you know he's not going to be on TV for a while. You know he's not going to be involved in Mania. And yet, after all that, you still then decide that you're just going to use Brett as a vehicle to get the belt on Sid. You could have found a way to get the belt on Sid without jobbing Brett out. So at this point, I don't think Vince does see him. Not to say he doesn't see value in Bret Hart, but he certainly doesn't think the value is what he's paying him.
Well, he never did. I mean, that's the interesting thing with Brett, as we mentioned Brett before, but you got to remember, Brett was the guy that he used as the, you know, the kind of the go-to guy when his actual desired plan fell apart, usually. So
yes, very true. But I do think there are, I don't want to sort of go into all psychoanalysis here by any means, but I do think, yeah. Well done. I like it. But I think this goes more down the line of what Kieran mentioned for about there's sort of the vindictive element of Vince tying in here, I think.
Over on Nitro, Prince Iaukea wins the television championship in a real, I think, a move that I really just thought was a complete rip off of Rocky at the time.
Yeah, well, it's off Regal as well, which is a carbon copy of the Triple H.
Yeah,
see.
This is the point at which the TV title should be forgotten completely.
They aired a video of Hall and Nash running the Steiners off the road and rolling their car. Laughter around the table. What a fucking piece of shit this was.
It was, but I will say this, I'm not condoning it, but it's this kind of wacky angle that wasn't done in wrestling before, and it's the kind of thing that's completely different, and it's going to draw the young 18 to 24s to wrestling. And as wacky and as stupid and as, you know, bullshit as we will say now, it was different, and that, you know, that was kind of summed up the NWA for me at that point.
All very true, absolutely true. But you have had the sold out show that's taken place, and even with the Steins getting the belts, they come across as pissants the following night because they have to give the belts back. Then they get run off the road. The Steins never get that moment off the outsiders, and it's just, you know, there has to be some give and take at some point, otherwise these things, which whilst not self-evident here, will come home to roost.
They also did a creative Roddy Piper promo said to be live from Alcatraz on this show. Piper talked into the toilet bowl at Hulk Hogan. Typical Piper intensity and lack of sense, but overall a great hype piece, says Meltzer. Nitro does a 3.0 to Raw's 2.1 for the first 2-hour battle. So Nitro still with the lead, Raw back down to 2.1 after a promising first go of it at the Sky Dome. Supposedly, Shawn Michaels asked Scott Hall this week if there was a spot open for him in WCW, although he's under a long-term contract with the WWF, so don't take that as something that is likely to happen. It's not exactly the best-kept secret that Ted Turner is supposed to appear at the March 3rd Nitro to fire Eric Bischoff. In fact, the story was not only released on WCW's own hotline, much to the chagrin of Booker Kevin Sullivan, but 2 days later was in a planted story in the New York Daily News Page 6 gossip column. Big Ted is coming to town on March 3rd. Vader has dropped close to 40 pounds. He was sent to the Duke University Weight Loss Clinic and met with a nutritionist to put him on a diet to get his weight under control. This was the reason that Vince felt that he couldn't push him as the WWF champion, because he thought he was too fat to get over for some reason.
I just imagine that episode of The Simpsons when, you know, they did the jiggle test on Homer's stomach.
Yeah.
It's like just this fat Leon on the treadmill just wobbling away.
There's a sitcom with Yoko and Vader at Duke University that should be made, at some point. We go now to February 23rd, WCW Super Brawl. 13,324 fans sell out the Cow Palace and 0.75 buy rate for 195,000 buy, so a return to a decent form here on the buy rates. Randy Savage turns heel to help Hulk Hogan beat Roddy Piper and join the NWO. The execution of this was fucking turd.
Oh, it's absolute horseshit. You've got Hogan in the sleeper, the arm drops 3 times, the ref calls it. The commentators during this time don't seem to notice that Savage pulls Hogan's legs under the rope.
They never mention it.
They don't mention it at any point. You know, the ref then sort of cottons on it, as is planned. But the fans in the arena aren't clear what's happening. When you're watching it on TV, it comes across as confusing because the commentators don't reference it. Then Hogan then gets the pin. The crowd are in stunned silence. And then 2 minutes later, after a continued beatdown of Piper, the spray paint of the NWO, then the commentators reference that the legs were under the rope, but still don't mention that Savage is the one that actually pulled them under the rope. The execution is terrible. It comes across bizarre because the crowd in the arena don't know what's going on.
The director as well, the camera crew, well, the production, they did the obviously the arm dropping down 3 times. I didn't clock that Savage had put the feet under the rope. I saw Savage as were at the ringside and Savage was doing anything, but I didn't clock at the time that he's put his feet under the rope, which is where you had mentioned the commentator should have come in and said, look what Savage is doing.
But I would argue that's because of the commentator, because you do see Savage clearly pull Hogan.
And then afterwards, during like the commotion, the camera then actually moves off what's happening in the ring and is just staring at Savage.
Yeah.
As Savage is just pacing up and down, he's fiddling with his pocket. It seems like he's pulling something in and out of his pocket. So they're concentrating on that part instead of actually focusing on in the ring, which is, I'm assuming, the referee kind of realizing that his foot's under the rope, turning to saying, no, match is going to continue. Piper going, oh, what are you talking about? Yada, yada, yada. Because by the time the camera moves back from Savage, you know, fluffing around, all you see him do is put, you know, the brass knucks or whatever, the tissue paper in Hogan's hand, and then the match is just starting. He just hits him and pins him, and he's just going, what the fuck? Complete miscommunication.
And the problem there is as well, because WCW's commentators aren't ringside, they don't really see what's going on in the ring because they're watching the monitor and they're watching just the focus on Savage. It's just a complete mess.
And you can also just tell, not just from that, but the crowd were completely confused as well, because the crowd pops for Piper winning, and then just like the match continues and the crowd are just like just stunned. They're like, what? What's going on? Well, what, Hogan's won now? And it's just like, it was kind of like, you could almost sense like the boos weren't necessarily like, ah, boo, they cheated again. It was just more like what the fuck have we just watched? I don't get the ending.
Good undercards of this show. In terms of the babyface getting a little bit of shine, Kevin Nash powerbombs the Giant, one of the best things Kevin Nash ever did.
Yeah.
But it does lead to the great moment where Lex Luger comes back with his arm in the cast, tags in, racks Nash. So there's some babyface shine here, although if I'm not mistaken, the belts go back to the outside. It's in very short order again.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
The medical, I think it's linked to the doctor. I think you also have 6 wins the Cruiserweight title off Malenko, as well, if I'm not mistaken, on this show, so it's another belt for them.
The original plan for the Uncensored main event is a 3-team deal with the NWO team, the WCW team, and finally introducing Sting's team. But the plans have changed due to the success of Piper at Super Brawl, so now he's going to have his own team. Sting had done the angle where he'd recruited Savage, recruited Paige, and obviously there was going to be a fourth. Somewhere prior to Super Bowl, when the tickets started selling very well, they decided there's more juice to Piper, let's go with him for another pay-per-view, we'll hold off Sting.
Yeah, because...
And that's when they put Savage in the NWO,
too. Yeah, yeah, because they said, because he wasn't in Team Piper.
I'm not sure if we did this on the last show, the success of Piper in the short term being that WCW's core base naturally skewed older, and I guess the theory's been that they remembered the early WrestleMania days, yeah, and the MTV build, and guys like Carl, who were in their 50s at the time, can remember it fondly, and you know, we're interested.
It was in colour, wasn't it?
I don't know, you tell me.
It blew my mind.
If it's black and white, your cataracts anyway, Carl.
Who said that?
Ken Shamrock signs with the WWF for a 2-year low 7-figure downside guarantee and signing bonus. The signing ends a pressure cooker of a week for Shamrock, who is torn between offers from the UFC, New Japan, the WWF, and a potential meeting with WCW. Ken Shamrock debuts later that night on the February 24th Raw in the crowd, treated like a celebrity, and does an interview with Lawler and an angle with Farouk. We'll talk about the rest of this episode of Raw very shortly, but Ken Shamrock joins the WWF.
Bit sketchy on my UFC. I'm looking over at Kieran on this if he has any idea. But I think by this point, Ken Shamrock's UFC career really was almost non-existent.
No, not at all. He's very much he's the face of the UFC at this point. If I'm not mistaken, he's actually the current UFC champion at the time of the signing.
It wasn't as hot as the early conception of it, so it was probably opportune time for him. But he wasn't a complete rookie. He'd been in Pancras in Japan, which was kind of a mixed shoot work company anyway, which was with a heavy pro wrestling influence. And I think he'd actually done some pro wrestling training.
He'd done some pro wrestling as Vince Torelli previously, but nothing major league.
Yeah, he'd worked indies in California, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. That's how he came across that running with the Nasty Boys in the hotel room a few years earlier.
Indeed it is.
I'm sure, Liam, you'll be able to tell me if this has any significant sway on the numbers. If memory serves me correctly, it doesn't. But
we have to go out on a limb there.
Yeah, I'm reaching. But I think it's a nice little boost for the company, just because it's a legitimately tough guy who's got a sort of reputation. It's the sort of thing that a company that's searching for something. It's just a little bit of a fillip to them.
Absolutely. Moving along now to the February 24th Raw, as we mentioned, other than Shamrock's debut, with most of the talent in Germany, this is where ECW appears, after Jerry Lawler invited them there the previous week. ECW matches throughout the show, and ECW pretty much gets the plug barely legal. Lawler is great on commentary during the course of this show. He's absolutely the star of the show for me. Heyman gets off a few zingers, but Lawler's just on fire all the way through. Meltzer talks about this Raw as a really horrible one for the WWF, because this is in the Manhattan Center, and obviously the fans, they get very into the novelty of the ECW matches, but the WWF matches and the WWF angles really come across pretty weak on this show, with most of the roster away in Germany. The LOD return on this show, which gets a great reaction from the fans, but then they put them in an 11-minute long match with the Headbangers that doesn't really...
Double count out?
Yeah, shit, really shitty. Just doesn't give anybody really what they want out of this.
I don't want to sound redundant here, but I'm going to anyway. It speaks to that scrambled thinking with Vince, because I can't think, if it's not for sheer sort of panic and desperation, I can't think of any reason why you would choose to showcase a smaller promotion which has no affinity to your wrestling audience at the time when you are losing so badly to WCW. I see no rhyme or reason to it, especially when you are starting the period, the most important period in the year for you, the build to WrestleMania.
And they're plugging barely legal instead.
Do you think that maybe it was a kind of, even for a temporary time, them trying to do something along the lines of the NWO? Was it him trying to try something like that?
I don't think so. I think it's a short... I mean, it was more to ECW's benefit to build up barely legal. And if you want to talk about Kieran's conspiracy corner, it's like this certainly has fuel to, you know, Vince McMahon and the Paul Lee connection at the time. Yeah, I don't think it was taken in a strong enough direction, apart from you had Lawler and the crossover and he'd go to ECW a few months later, whatever. Very little in terms of cross-promotion interaction. So it was just like, as Carl said, it was just throwing shit against the wall. We'd all see them use guys from AAA, and it was just another something different again. Let's see if it connects. You also had this really weird dynamic of, you know, the WWF voice was Lawler.
Yeah.
But he was like the ultimate douche heel, being at his brilliant best, but defending the company and burying ECW. It was a real strange dynamic.
Yeah.
The angle was, for me, the angle was totally written from an ECW perspective, with real no long-term benefit to WWF in sight, really.
We move over to Nitro. A far better show than Raw, says Dave Meltzer. Hall, Nash and Savage come out and KO Diamond Dallas Page with a spray paint can and spray paint him. A fan hit the ring during the brawl, which was funny because the fan forgot to sell Hall and Savage's punches. Savage then put on an NWO t-shirt. Savage dropped some elbows on Page and he did a stretcher job. They did an interview where they presented Savage with Elizabeth, and Elizabeth smiled for the first time in months. So yeah, this is very much setting up the Page-Savage feud that's to come. Big Angle setting up the Uncensored main event, however. Sting comes out and seems to be neutral, turns towards the NWO side, and Hogan hugs him, but Sting doesn't hug him back and keeps the blank look as the show goes off the air. So you've established at this point the WCW side and the NWO side. The element of Sting, you know, whose side's he on, whose side's he on, it's been going on for months now. It's been a constant thing.
I'm more intrigued to what's going to happen with Team Piper. I can't wait to see who he picks for his team.
Oh, that's coming.
So have they named the Stips for it yet?
Well, actually, they kind of made him up as they went along. Yeah, they kind of made him up as they went along. It was really weird, actually, wasn't it? It was like, so if NWO, hang on, let's try and figure this out.
I think it was something along the line.
If NWO wins,
they get, I think it was supposed to be a title shot at any time they want of any choosing.
Yeah,
but it kind of turned
much into
carte blanche over the company.
Yeah.
But did they lose the belts?
They lost all the belts to the other team, regardless of whatever the fuck happened.
Obviously.
The one thing I will say, because I've criticised WCW enough during this podcast, so I'll give them a bit, some credit where it's due. We talk about sort of just throw things together, like Giant and Hogan, they tease on TV as a singles match before the pay-per-view, and all those things that they would sort of rush through. I'll give them credit for the way that they held off on Sting, because the temptation must have been so great, and you know they were doing such good numbers, and but they'd had a couple of bad pay-per-view buys. So you could almost foresee it, couldn't you? Bischoff will sort of panic, and he'll go to Sting early off the back of a sold-out number, that sort of thing. So I give them all the credit in the world for still continuing to hold off, while still maintaining the interest of the viewing audience at home and the fans in the arena in terms of the intrigue where Sting's concerned.
Nitro does a 3.0 this week for Raw's 2.4. The Raw rating actually peaked at a 2.7 for the Blue World Order, which is notable only for, again, Lawler's great lines where he says he calls the BWO a rip-off and a parody, and Heyman goes, what are we ripping off here, King? And there's just no way to answer that at all, which is just great. However, you weren't the only people to not like the way this went. Bret Hart in the Calgary Sun says, the style of ECW matches on Raw was changed to make them acceptable to censors and fans. You'd think ECW followers would be outraged that the ECW matches on Raw weren't hardcore. You'd think they'd turn on Paulie for selling out everything he's been preaching to them. Instead, they just waved at the cameras.
Didn't on commentary it was mentioned, I think Lawler, I can't remember who said it to Paulie, and he says why give it away on TV when you can, you know, we can give it away on pay-per-view and or something like that. But you basically use it as a plug for Bayley Legal. So.
Yeah, he does reference it, but I think it's after a few matches. It's almost like it's almost as if someone's in the headset saying, we'd better just preface this for why we're not showing what we talk about. Yeah, well, far be it from me to have a little cheap shot at the ECW fans, but here goes. The Manhattan Center is filled with ECW fans for a Raw show. They're the counterculture, they're cool, they're hip. What gets the biggest reaction on that show?
LOD.
It's LOD's entrance for a match with the Headbangers. Vince has got your money.
Was this the week when Sabu fell off the Raw?
Yeah.
He fell off the logo, yeah.
Fell off the R. Another attempt to monetize the NWO falls flat. The NWO hotline bombs. In the entire first month, it did about the same business as the WCW hotline does on a normal day. Again, we've had the NWO pay-per-view as a massive failure. The NWO hotline here does not do well. So yeah, an interesting kind of turn of events here. That they were really reaching. They thought they had the golden hand here, and every time they tried to play it above the natural reach of it as a wrestling angle, it hasn't panned out. We move to 1 week later. We are now in March. March 3rd, Nitro. It's the last show ever done in the Omni for WCW, as a matter of fact. Roddy Piper proved himself to not be bulletproof, and WCW unleashed an ill-fated angle that failed by Loch Ness proportions, a failure that virtually everyone in the organization immediately recognized as it was going on. It was Piper's idea to introduce his own four-man team for Uncensored and pick the guys that he wanted to be in the match. Of course, this is the horrible angle where he has the tryouts live on Nitro with six individuals, three of which are from the power plant, which get wasted, three of which succeed, which is his friend and their personal bodyguard and Brutai, his own personal Brutai, as Meltzer says, Craig Malley, a kickboxing dude with a Kenny Powers mullet, and John Tenta as the Earthquake, who comes in.
He's not a fish.
I'm a man. A 500-pound man. Yeah. The crowd turned on this something fierce while it was going on. WCW backstage are terrified that Piper's killing his future drawing power. WCW was enjoying its greatest advantage in the history of the Monday Night Wars with an incredible 3-point lead, tripling the audience for Raw at the same time. A 4.5 for Piper's tryouts against the 1.5 for Sid and Mankind during that quarter hour. So there you go, there's the ratings, Carl. This somehow was a massive success despite the fact that it was fucking awful.
When you're hot, you're hot. Yeah. I have no explanation for it.
Maybe the potential of Piper bringing some new stars in who can compete after all the current stars have been fucking killed for months on end.
Yeah, maybe some intrigue.
Something
there.
Different, maybe. Maybe that also plays into the Goldberg thing eventually, why he gets over, because he's a fresh new star who might have a chance because he hasn't been killed all this time. Who knows?
True, but you'd think as soon as they saw who appeared on screen, the segment would just bomb.
As it turns out, Ted Turner, who was supposed to be on the show, as we mentioned earlier, decided he didn't want to do a wrestling angle after all and sent Dr. Harvey Schiller, who runs TBS Sports, in his place, and he suspends Eric Bischoff as the WCW Executive Vice President. Over on Raw, March 3rd, this was the one taped in Germany, British Bulldog wins the European title with a great match with Owen Hart, otherwise a pretty flat show, but that's the only thing of note. Really fun match. And the longest match in quite some time since they started the war.
Yeah, I mean, they'd, for a few weeks before, I've been teasing like the dissension with him and Owen.
Oh, they've been doing that for a while. Yeah. Probably about 2 months, but two or three months at this point.
Long.
Yeah, yeah.
Owen
eliminated him in the Rumble.
And they'd been little back and forth things in matches where they'd been, yeah, a nice bit of planning there, and they paid it off with a really good match.
Yeah, very good. Nitro this week is a 3.4 to Raw's 1.9. So after the original 2-hour war looked like it was going to be in WWF's favour, it's actually gone the other direction, and things are still looking pretty bad for WWF.
Yeah, that's fucking awful for Raw, because that's no shift at all in like numbers. No, in terms of like, it's not like the low number for Raw is because they all started watching Nitro or anything. They just stopped watching. It's just like the Nitro number's the same, but
you gotta keep in mind here, those original 3.4s and stuff that WCW was doing was because they had the 1 hour unopposed.
Yeah.
Now they've got no hours unopposed, and they're doing 3.4s anyway, whereas Raw is the one that's taken the hit, if anyone is. After the disaster of the Piper angle, the plan is immediately switched, so it's the Four Horsemen who's going to be on Roddy Piper's team. So this is written off on Tuesday morning, pretty much. Dennis Rodman, the regularly suspended current leading anti-hero of the NBA Chicago Bulls, will be part of the New World Order and appear at the Uncensored pay-per-view show and make what is believed to be 2 additional appearances with WCW as a participant in matches, the first of which is scheduled for the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view in July. As you remember, the WWF had offered Rodman a 2-show deal, reportedly for $1 million, which was Mania and SummerSlam, but WCW was able to pull off a major coup here by getting Rodman because they were in the Chicago Sun-Times nearly every day promoting the Uncensored pay-per-view, while the WWF have had WrestleMania in the exact same city 1 week later and didn't get a mention at all. Huge coup here from a publicity standpoint.
Didn't they also offer $2 million for 3 dates?
Yeah, they offered more. The big thing was that Goldust was failing miserably as a character, especially during this quarter where just everything, he was getting booed on house shows. March 10th, Nitro in Panama City. So we've got the floating ring here for the first time. Roddy Piper did an interview, obviously majorly pissed off at the reaction to his ultimate ego angle from the previous week. Piper said that the WWF was right about there being no one-hip wrestlers in the company, saying there isn't one-hip wrestler in the entire company. This is after Jim Ross mentioned incessantly during the European title match about how this isn't the seniors tour or the over 40s club. Piper didn't like that at all and decided to live on Nitro expresses frustration, saying the reason why everyone's watching WCW pay-per-views is because your guys aren't hip.
WCW, you know, it's got the rep, and probably rightly so, as like this lawless land where people cutting shoot promos all over. But when Sullivan's your lead booker and he's
doing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really skeptical that to assume anything's a wrestler going into business for himself, because it's who's to say Sullivan didn't say, I don't know, it all fucking all got, everyone sounds like Carl when I get over 60, so who cares?
Well, I think that you're probably right there, Kieran. It's probably one of those where you could see that with Sullivan being the bookie, you can see that direction and them sort of grasping at the nettle, so to speak. The problem is that it's what sets the precedent for later years. Because they're allowed to do it at this stage, I don't want to say they're like children, but it's almost like a, we don't know any better, we've always been allowed to do this, so screw it, we're just going to do it anyway. And it's all these little things that we talk about here, that whilst the company's fine now, as we say, when we get further on in the series, we will backtrack and talk about how we went through the list, we talked about these things, and this is where the shit hits the fan.
Yeah, absolutely. Piper, during this program, says he isn't a fair weather friend and isn't going to drop his three chosen guys until Flair and Arn come out. And Arn says it's a job for professionals, not amateurs, and Piper changes his mind and uses the Horseman instead. The NWO does an interview, again, Hogan and Sting. This time Hogan gives Sting an NWO t-shirt, but he just stands there with the mime face and doesn't take it. So again, it's not necessarily all that clear yet what's going on with Sting. Over on Raw, this is the first time, March 10th, it's actually Raw is War. New name to the show, the Titantron debuts, and it's structured a lot more like Monday Nitro, with a lot of angles, a lot of interviews, and lots of very quick squash matches. Ken Shamrock's brought out, and Steve Austin appears on the video while running him down.
Oh, another wonderful appearance from Steve here.
Bret Hart's music hits while Steve's on the Titantron, and Austin's just looking around like, what the fuck's going on here? Yeah, it's
just
great.
Just ranting about being covered, and then he just walks, storms off, and you're waiting for him to appear.
Bret Hart comes out instead, and there's a long interview complaining about everything, mainly to hype WrestleMania. He does get the funny line in here, if I'm not mistaken, about how I lost the title 3 weeks ago. I like being a four-time champion, incidentally.
Bret and Shamrock in the ring.
Yeah.
Does Austin just walk out and gives them both the
finger? The finger and walks off.
Walks out, gives them the finger and walks off. What a star.
Also on the show, we get another Paul Heyman, Jerry Lawler debate in the ring. Tries to do that whole rallying the audience about giving them what they want, but it's a pretty cold crowd. This just comes off like they're talking over the audience's heads. Although there is, again, another great zinger from Heyman talking about how stuff going by the seesaw in Louisville.
Yeah, and as much as that line gets a chuckle out of us all, I thought it was hilarious when I heard it. It's just, it's a very straight. It's a car wreck of a segment, really.
No, it's awful. Talking over each other.
The crowd aren't with it at all. And also, just to stress the point again, this is against the backdrop of the build to WrestleMania, and you're spending a significant chunk of your TV time not showcasing your wrestlers, but showcasing what is a part-time wrestler commentator with a smaller promotion plugging their pay-per-view.
They go with the main event of Vader and Mankind against Taker and Sid, where the latter team falls apart to set up their great WrestleMania epic. Not just a 3.5 to Raw's 2.3, no big change there. Last we've heard is that Arn Anderson is expected to be out for 4 months and may undergo surgery to fuse 3 vertebrae in his neck. The neck injury, which is apparently a flaring up of an injury 7 years ago caused in a match with the Steiners, has caused his hand to go numb, which is where the original misdiagnosis came in. However, as we'll find out, unfortunately, this is it. This is not 4 months. This is it.
I've always hated Rick Steiner.
For this in particular?
This in particular, this hurts.
Yeah, 1999 didn't help Rick Steiner's cause either for me. That's Sunday, March 16th, it's WCW Uncensored. Dave Meltzer summarises by saying, the lines are familiar, good undercard, terrible main event, booking like Swiss cheese. So, yeah.
Yeah, this main event with this three-team Battle Royal, Royal Rumble, whatever. I watched this match many times. This was on my Best of Uncensored video, which I still got to lend to Carl.
Was this the only match?
No, there were other ones, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. What actually made this tape even worse is that they didn't start the match from the beginning. It just kind of came in like 10 minutes in.
I would argue that probably makes the tape better.
Yeah, it probably did. The only person who was good on Piper's team was Benoit.
Rick Steiner, maybe paying for the sins of hurting Arn Anderson, is taken out of the match backstage, lying face down. So it's actually three people on Team WCW, just because they're that good.
Yeah, I just remember Benoit being the only good guy on Piper's team, thinking like, well, they're not winning. And also, like, Scott Stein does some pretty neat stuff in this match as well. The NWO going over all the fucking time, because
Luger gets some shine, which Kieran's a big fan of.
Yeah, that's you know, it actually kind of worked like pretty well. Like Luger's on his own, and then he's up against Hogan, Nash, Hall, and Savage, if I remember right, and he systematically takes them out all out one by one with the torture rack, and looks like he's going to take out Hogan. The usual bullshit, and like the crowd are fucking really eating this up, and they're really popping for Luger. I mean, big time. They're really popping for him just destroying the NWO. But again, like with every fucking show, the NWO have to go over, and so they turn the screws.
And in the case of Uncensored, it is one instance where I'll give the devil his due, because you have to have the NWO go over here.
There's two reasons, I think,
to then have the Sting beat down.
Absolutely.
Because without that, if Luger wins,
no need for Sting.
There's no need for Sting then. So it serves a purpose there. I'm more than happy for the NWO to go over in this scenario, because it's leading to something else, and it is allowing the babyfaces to get some shine, even though they haven't won the match. there's that element of they stand triumphant at the end.
Absolutely. And again, since they just got Rodman, it was such a huge coup. If they're going to have him wrestle for the first time in July, I don't think it makes any sense for Rodman to be on the losing team straight away. So in this case, I will say I think that was fine. There was an incident in the ring with Kevin Nash and Roddy Piper where Nash wasn't selling for Piper, which caused a lot of frustration that would bleed into the second quarter. Sting attacking the end of it after months and months and months of build is just fucking phenomenal. And one of the best, I just love this moment. I can watch this any day of the week, and the crowd is just absolutely pissing their pants, and it's just, it's awesome. It's
He's
awesome.
He's pointing at me!
The Hogan pout up there with terrible expressions such as the Vince gulp of doom.
We get the DDP Savage Angle spray painting Kimberly, as well as the reveal of her as a nudie celeb in a magazine, to set up DDP and Savage for Spring Stampede in April. True to form and keeping their storylines consistent, the final name in the credits was the WCW Senior Vice President Eric Bischoff, who was just suspended on television. Another faux pas that I caught when watching this back was the fact that in the opening video they say Prince Iaukea will be defending his cruiserweight title when he's the television champion. So that's great stuff.
Isn't this the one where the credits are all on all the credits there on first names, except for there's like the key grip or someone who's mentioned twice.
Yeah, someone's mentioned twice. I can't remember who it is.
I don't.
Carpenters.
Yeah, the Carpenters. That's it. And I just, can anyone explain to me? Maybe someone can email in and explain this to me why they bothered to have credits on the pay per view. I just don't understand it.
Because Eric Bischoff is the executive of a TV show, Carl. It's not a wrestling company.
Email us, please. Don't waste your time. Thank you, Kieran.
Dr. Death Steve Williams was involved in serious negotiations with the WWF over the past week for a feud with Ken Shamrock, but was arrested on the morning of March 17th for smuggling 162 boxes of painkillers to the airport. So that's the end of Dr. Death's negotiations, for now at least. Maybe he'll fare better in shoot competition in the WWF in future, who knows. Also, on the All Japan scouting front, Del Wilkes, the Patriot, has agreed to a WWF deal this week, so we'll see him later. March 17th, Nitro. The main event was the Steiners vs. Harlem Heat, which went to a no contest when the NWO ran in and beat them both up. Luger and Giant ran in to make the save and ran the NWO off. The show ended with Sting once again coming down from the ceiling, joining up with WCW and pointing his bat at Hogan, who sold the idea that he was being marked by Sting fantastically. This is him in the aisle this time again. He's pointing at me. The same thing. Over on Raw, a very hot show, the go-home show for WrestleMania 13. It's March 17th here for Raw. Bret Hart and Sid in a steel cage with Sid retaining the championship. Obviously, the stipulation here is if Bret wins the belt, then Bret and Austin will be for the title at WrestleMania and not take a Sid. And tragically, Sid gets the win. So it's got the nice dynamic here of Sid of Austin trying to help Bret and Taker trying to help Sid because they both selfishly want the title match at WrestleMania. So it's an interesting dynamic. Bret loses and we get that the great profanity-laced promo where he's just ripping the WWF to shreds. The fans, if you don't like it, tough shit. And it leads to a great angle to close the show. Everybody's brawling. It's crazy. It's great.
Absolutely fantastic. I love that element of you've got the babyface trying to help sort of the quasi-heel in Sid win, and you've got the heel in Austin trying to help the babyface Bret win. It all makes perfectly logical sense because they're putting importance on the title. God, what a novel concept. But a really, really enjoyable end to the show. The Bret promo is fantastic. All that sort of
That pent-up frustration over 3 months of snide comments about how he's being screwed over, and eventually it just builds up to this massive tornado.
Is this the one? Okay, this is fucking fantastic.
The aggression all just comes spewing out. Steve Austin has his bit on the titan again just to stir the pot. You're a loser, Bret! Pat Patterson gets decked. Vince almost calls Bret a son of a bitch on commentary. Yeah.
Bret dropping the S-bombs.
Jesus Christ himself, HBK, manages to walk out on his one bad leg. Stumbles around like a drunk man and grabs a chair. I think he was okay. There may have been something wrong.
it's just the execution of it. It's just like it's just so well timed as well. I think like the putting the cage down as well, and he's just not leaving because he's gonna have his say. And it's just like this is where like he can talk. He's not the most dynamic, but in fairness, at this point now where he's really feeling something.
Bret's promos have always been true to the character that he believes himself to be, and that this is what this is. It's kind of an extension of that, and that's why it's real and it's fucking brilliant.
It's just finally honing into it. There's nothing flamboyant about it. As I said, it's just Bret being Bret Hart.
There's a logic to it all, and it's the authenticity to it. You mentioned that Bret portraying who in his core, he believes he isn't. It's almost depressing to think about now, as enjoyable as that is, that you don't get anything like that. There's no authenticity to the product at all.
No, what I will say, I'll throw this back to you. When I was watching this back, I just couldn't help but feel so depressed about how, goddamn, they would never let anything like this happen today. Not just the swearing, not just the intensity, the letting him go off on his own accord, and then the brawling, just doing what they want. It's not hokey, it's not choreographed, we're not getting the big dive in there. It was just two guys who are pissed, we're fighting, we're pissed off, and this Sunday we're going to fight at WrestleMania. And granted, it doesn't speak well when you look at the buy rate for WrestleMania. Yeah. In terms of exciting television, this is just where it's at.
You just kind of see, like, I don't want this to be a bitch on John Cena or anyone else, but you just see them just kind of go, oh, hey-ho, you know, and it's just like, be on their way. I mean, like, even like you know, great promos like the Punk pipe bomb. Punk sat down and he's saying everything calmly. He's not letting loose. It's all very well constructed and comes across like, very, very well planned in comparison.
Very articulate. Yeah,
very articulate in comparison to Brett, who's just blaring it all out. It just comes a lot more
raw emotion.
Raw emotion, rather than now where it's just so blatant. It's off a script.
Well, yeah,
so that's the apt word though. It's in this modern day of they're so structured because they're so. And when you look at the disjointed nature of what we're going to talk about in more in future episodes about the disjointed nature of WCW's production, you can understand why today corporate WWE is so heavily structured to, you know, especially timing wise on their show. You look at compared two scripts, an old script to a modern day Raw script a few weeks ago, and how heavily scripted it is now. It's that control over timings and everything. It's in that modern setting, there isn't leeway for someone just to go run loose and cut a promo which might go 5 minutes, might go 7 minutes, might go 10 minutes, might go 12 minutes.
Meltzer mentions here with the nature of the language of this promo, the entire WWF is definitely going for a much rougher edge as last week's Farooq Ahmed Johnson interview saw them use terms like black ass and charcoal colour back and forth. I was getting a little bit thick pretty shortly in when they were doing those promos. Nitro does a 3.6 to Raw's 2.4 for the go-home show for WrestleMania. The August Clash of the Champions has been officially cancelled because by that time, TBS will be running a two-hour weekly live show, which is almost a sure thing now for Thursday nights. Of course, the irony there being that actually it wouldn't happen by the time August comes around. The WWF and the USA Network spent a lot of money over the past week buying radio ads and were pushing Raw as a show where you'll see people hitting each other with chairs and 2x4s in the head every week. The real Double J, Jesse James, has been out of action as he was suspended for 6 weeks on one of those notorious company policy violations.
Jesse Jams.
Jams, with the two M's. Yeah. Jake Roberts was also fired for similar reasons, and Scott Hall voluntarily checked himself into rehab this week, missing the next episode of Nitro.
I bet he's paid though, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he was paid. He absolutely was paid. So drugs are all the rage. March 23rd, we move to WrestleMania 13. 18,197 fans in the Rosemont Horizon, a 0.77 buy rate for 197,000 buys, the lowest drawing WrestleMania of all time, as Taker and Psycho Sid main event for the WWF Championship.
Besides 95, I think this 97 WrestleMania holiday period, whatever you want to call it, it's just so weak. We can all talk about Bret Hart, Austin, and I'm sure Carl can talk for 2 hours alone about it, you know, and we could all give an extra hour here and there, but and that match is absolutely great, but the rest of the card is just poor. I'm sorry, as I said before, I don't find that much entertainment in the Chicago street fight personally. I just don't. I mean, I don't know whether it's just the thought of Crush on screen just annoys me.
I will say the amount of Crush wins in this 3 month period on Raw is fucking disgraceful.
Unforgivable.
It's just the rest of the card is just poor. And I mean, man, I'll be surprised if anyone actually, in retrospect, carries on watching that pay per view after the Bret Austin match, or whether they just press stop on the tape and just go, that's done. Because I've only ever watched that Sid Vicious, Psycho Sid, wrong company, versus Undertaker match once, and that was enough.
Of course, no one watches it after Bret Austin. That main event is the absolute shits, and if you don't believe me, just look at Sid's tights. There's not too much that needs to be said about this as an individual show, really. We've talked about it before. The main event's terrible. There's nothing on the undercard. I enjoy the plunder of the street.
Novel for the time.
Yeah, novel for the time. I'm not saying it's great. I'm not saying it's something you look back on as a classic, but it's an enjoyable, you know, 10-15 minutes. And Austin Bret is the greatest match in company history and the cementing of Steve Austin as a major player.
Meltzer, of course, gives it 5 stars and says this is one we'll remember for a long, long time. And he was completely accurate about that.
Actually, just something else, because I don't think we ever actually talked about it when we were doing the WrestleMania walkthrough.
Rocky yeah. Sultan?
Yeah. Yeah, just all the flamboyant punches. Oh, Rocky, don't worry, it gets better.
I'm going to use that to accompany the Garvin stomp on the dance floor.
just about the Bret Hart Austin match. Just as like a little kind of side note, because I don't think we talked about it, like Ken Shamrock being involved in that match, wearing I think probably the same T-shirt as Vince McMahon would later wear in 98. It was that freaking tight
Lycra cycle shorts, I think.
I think we just stole from Shawn Michaels, yeah. I think. But
actually, probably the exact same pair because they were much tighter on Shamrock.
Yeah, yeah. I always kind of like that end bit as well, where Brett just continues doing the stomp down and like shugs Ken Shamrock off, and then Cameron Shamrock just hits the suplex on him, and just
don't forget Brett flips off a fan on his way out.
Yeah, that's Brett, great. So it's just subtle, small things that are just brilliant. I cannot emphasize enough how perfect this match and this whole setup from start to finish, not just bell to bell, the intros, the outros, the commentary, everything about this is just so fucking on point that in this absolute I will say right now, it is an absolute miracle that in this 3-month period where they can do absolutely nothing right, plans are changing left, right and centre. This match was not even supposed to happen. There was no plan for Steve Austin at WrestleMania even 2 months ago, and yet somehow they've constructed the most perfect piece of professional wrestling they may have ever done in the middle of it all.
Out of this compost heap of horseshit blooms a wonderful rose by the name of Steve Austin wearing the crimson mask, and off to the races we will go.
And it just kind of just bring back
beautiful man
back to the point. It's just it just kind of proves that by the fact that having a guest referee didn't detract from the match at all. When something like that would usually like take your focus away, it didn't. Ken Shamrock played his role very well. He didn't hog the limelight or anything like that. He just did his job well. Then when it came to when it was his limelight, he executed it brilliantly. And that shows you how good the match was. It wasn't just the obvious two superb talents in Austin and Brett. It was everything. It was the commentary. It was the family at ringside. It was Ken Shamrock in the ring doing his job right. It was just all the components together. It wasn't just Austin and Brett.
And it's the authenticity of having a legitimate fighter in Shamrock, who's not hogging the line, actually, but you've got this authentic fighter involved in what looks a very gritty, very real, very authentic fight.
Yeah, the next night on Raw, March 24th, we have a great Bret Hart promo, pretty much recapping the entire past year of events where Bret's been getting shafted time after time after time. I actually really like this promo a lot. It's not the most, again, we're talking about articulate, glib, perfectly delivered and pronunciated promos. That was not this, but I thought that in terms of effectiveness for Brett, just bitching and bitching and bitching and telling the fans to kiss his ass at the end, it's a fantastic promo. Sean comes out to respond and does a promo calling him Mark Man and talking about how Brett Hart's, you know, he's not a nice guy and all this stuff. So Sean gets to get some digs back in on Brett here. So Sean's bare his teeth at Brett Hart.
Hadn't Brett as well up to the when he was going for the title match the week before Mania, wasn't he making comments about how he wouldn't pull out of WrestleMania with a fake knee injury and things like this as well? So it's going backwards and forth.
Yeah.
And was this the Brett promo where he apologises to his European fans, the Far East fans, and everyone but says American go kiss his ass?
But American wrestling, no one glorifies criminal conduct like the Americans.
I think it's an absolutely brilliant promo. Again, it comes across as genuine and authentic, and I love that juxtaposition of I'm going to make the American fans the heels to everyone else, and it's that nice sort of setup for the way they would crisscross North America in the summer and the European tour they do. I just love that dynamic because we haven't seen it before and we haven't seen it since. I just think it's one of those really unique, really fascinating things.
Wasn't as well the Brett took digs at Sean for being in Playgirl and he called it like a queer gay magazine or something, and Sean was like,
How do you know? To flick through it yourself, didn't you? Yeah. So the Headbangers are against their Owen and Davey this week, and the team breaks apart to tease the singles match for next week, Owen versus Davey. The culmination, it's gotten heated now. The tag team, they're going to fight each other. It's going to be a fight, not a wrestling match like it was in Germany. It's going to be a fight next week, and we'll see how that plays out. Over on Nitro, Larry Hennig is sitting in the front row. An interesting story, just because at WrestleMania, the WWF was trying to strong-arm Kurt Hennig, who had agreed to a deal with WCW, to make a surprise appearance at WrestleMania. And Hennig was not too thrilled about this. And even though he couldn't appear yet on WCW, because he was still contractually obligated to the WWF at the time, this was the very obvious message being sent to the WWF. My dad is in WCW, so I will be soon too. So, interesting little touch there. No Sting, no Piper, no Hogan on this show. Randy Savage versus Prince Iaukea is the main event, with Diamond Dallas Page and then the NWO running out for a beatdown on Iaukea and DDP. With the lack of star power on Nitro coming the day after WrestleMania, the new world champion, The Undertaker, and of course, Austin and Bret. Nitro does a 3.0 and Raw does a 2.5, so they do pull that divide back slightly somewhat this week. Kevin Nash has been very vocal of late about he and Scott Hall selling too much and putting people over too much.
What? When?
There seem to be major sides being drawn between the Hogan camp, which Hall and Nash are a big part of, and the Sullivan camp, consisting of the Horseman and Roddy Piper. So that's an interesting note that will come to fruition in the following quarter.
I want to know what jobs Iaukea have been doing for Bob Ryder to get involved in that ending segment.
There's a chance that Charles Wright will be back in the WWF very soon. I mention this not because this is important right now, but there's a very interesting note in the second quarter that we'll come to about Charles Wright, the Godfather, and his imminent return to the WWF. The plan in the not-too-distant future is also for a Benoit versus Ric Flair feud, and for Benoit to form his own horseman with Dean Malenko, Chris Jericho, and Steven Regal, an idea that never came to see the light of day. We move to the final Nitro and Raw of this quarter, March 31st. Hogan, Bischoff and DiBiase were at the Dennis Rodman movie premiere, so they weren't there again. They introduced the WCW Women's Cruiserweight title. Anybody remember this?
What?
No. Yeah. Women's Cruiserweight title?
Yes.
So does that mean that there is a Women's Heavyweight title?
Yes.
See, I was going to say, I don't recall there still being a women's belt at this point, just general one.
It's there, it's rarely ever on Nitro. The women's cruiserweight belt, I think the actual champion was crowned on WCW main event, and I'm not sure if it ever appeared on Nitro after some of the introductory stuff. Nash did a promo saying Scott Hall is dealing with problems far bigger than the wrestling business. Nash, also in his interview and throughout the show, teased the idea that he, Six and Hall, were tired of Hogan and Bischoff, and that they would break away as they were talking with Scott Norton and Michael Wall Street earlier in the show about which side they were on. The interview that Nash did was totally not what it was supposed to be. Sullivan wanted him to do a promo running down Hogan and Bischoff for not being there as an idea for a one-week storyline to build up the ratings. But Sullivan also asked him to run down Scott Hall, which Nash refused to do, apparently believing it was some kind of trick, and instead praised Hall and did the rest of his interview talking about Little Napoleon backstage giving orders. Which obviously is an allusion
what
to Sullivan.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Complete and utter bullshit.
Just, yeah. And there's more of this to come in the following quarter, believe me.
It's behaviour that they've only got themselves to blame. It's behaviour that, if not openly encouraged, was at least tacitly supported, because no one ever got punished for it. And when you've got the booker himself doing it, you know, monkey see, monkey do, you can't very, you know, once to steal a cornet line, the toothpaste is out of the tube then. You can't put it back in.
I'll just pose the question, did this, because ratings were still going to go up from here, was this aura of something real might happen?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Did it help?
I don't know if it helped, but the belief certainly. Mm. I mean, just look at this stuff with Sullivan and Benoit, Sullivan and Pillman. There's a Jim Mitchell shoot interview where I remember him saying that he was talking to Kevin Sullivan, and Sullivan just said, use your real name because everything's a shoot now anyway.
That's it, and like I said, that's what I mean by sort of, it's that tacit support, if nothing else. You know, you don't condone it at the time, and the ratings seem to be, a bad week is when the ratings hold steady, just to, you know, to show you how well they were doing. The gravy train is picking up momentum. Why rock the boat with this? Let's just let them carry on because it's working.
Over on Raw, which is a much better show this week, Davey and Owen have a good match with Bret Hart coming out, telling them to stop fighting and reforming the Hart Foundation.
Owen cries.
Owen cries.
Owen, oh, God. This is Owen returning to Survivor Series 94 form. And absolutely,
even Lawler buys into this. And he talks, yeah, what a touching moment this is, yeah, for the Hart family.
It's wonderful. Wonderful.
Also on this Raw, Mankind throws a fireball at The Undertaker. Sid runs in for the save and then consequently does a promo afterwards. Funny note here from Meltzer. True story. At the WCW booking meeting earlier that day, they had laid out the Akira Hokuto versus Debbie Combs women's title match, and the remark was made they are sure to lose this quarter hour. And someone said, unless the WF put Sid on at the same time. And lo and behold, as they were watching Raw while that match was on, Sid was on the screen, and they won the quarter hour. That's just fantastic. Nitro does a 3.5 to Raw's 2.7. So again, upward momentum here for Monday Night Raw. The first time in a good while, we've seen a decent number here. Head-to-head for 2 hours, 2.7. Some final notes to close out this quarter. We've gone through a lot here so far. The National Enquirer ran a piece this week regarding Rey Mysterio Jr. and Jennifer Aniston, but there's absolutely nothing to that one. It was just an attempt, which succeeded, to get Mysterio some pub since WCW wants to push him big time, which you would never know by watching the television or the fact that he's lost on the last 5 straight pay-per-views. They also had, I don't know, there's a note in here somewhere about how on all the Nitro trucks, production trucks, the three faces on the truck were Hogan, Savage, and Mysterio. Oddly enough, it's like they think they're going to push him, and they kind of want to, but they're never going to, you know what I mean? What will surprise a lot of people is that right now the WCW merchandise is doing about 70% to 30% edge over the NWO merchandise. So here we are, a few months after the NWO start, and the WCW merch is already picking up. There's a note that Sting's t-shirt has already taken over the NWO's primary t-shirt.
If you look at the sort of total number, it ranks pretty high, but it's clear in terms of its initial burst, it's relatively short shelf life, I suppose you'd say, in terms of like the number one seller, and certainly doesn't deserve to be put into the same sort of category as the Austin 316 shirt.
No, I remember asking the Meltz himself once which was the best selling shirt, and he just responded simply with 316 by an absolute mile. Yeah. TNT and USA were locked at a 2.0 average for the first quarter of 1997. Interesting, because they're battling head to head for the number one cable network, which is, again, we're talking about the leverage they were trying to use before. Here they're neck and neck going to the second quarter of 1997. And the big long term plan right now, and a final note, is for Starrcade to become their version of WrestleMania and hold the Hogan versus Sting match off until then, and trying to promote it as the biggest match in the history of the company. So that's the final note for this quarter. Hogan and Sting, they have their long-term vision.
That being the last note sort of sums it up nicely, because you've got WCW who have their long-term vision, and the WWF are now starting to find theirs. Not necessarily in business metrics, perhaps. Although, obviously, you referenced that stronger Raw numbers as the last number of the quarter. Creatively speaking, they're at least finding a more surer footing than they were certainly at the turn of 97. Brett and Shawn's still going to be the match, but Brett's losing on TV. Vader's getting a win over the Undertaker, but we've got no real serious plans for Vader, to be honest. To then going to Sid versus Taker and Brett Shawn being the semi-main at WrestleMania, to them having no plans initially for Austin, to him being in the greatest match in company history. And it's just, you know, they've finally found something with Austin. They've found a direction with Brett. Shawn is still featured heavily in the TV, you know, knee or no knee, even if he's not there, his name is mentioned. There's the aggression of the promos, there's the more colourful language. They're finding a footing, and it's just whether or not they can create the overarching theme for the company as a whole going forward.
Yeah, and it's just on the WCW side, it's actually nice to see that they've actually got a plan set in place. They kind of realised, obviously, Hogan being the number one heel and Sting being the guy to beat him. And as you said already early in the podcast, it's impressive that they've chosen, you know, not to blow their load early and do it at the end of the year, make Starrcade the new WrestleMania. There's absolutely no way they can fuck this up.
I think just from the WF point of view, even though they've had moments of creative high points with Brett and Austin, with Austin going face now, they'd finally develop an act, if you want to call it that, that was cool.
Yeah.
And that was
a big thing that was lacking.
Exactly. It was cool and it was contemporary, and it was something they always had lacking. I said the initial burst of the NWO, and I say argue because at the end of the day they were heels, so when the story settled down they were heels. Yeah. So after that initial burst they were cool, and that was still going to go in the momentum. But with Austin they finally had something, and as much as I love Shawn, he wasn't cool. Yeah. And you could argue the same.
Tell me I like it.
And you could argue, you know, the same with Brett. You know, no one will argue how good Brett is, but to a mainstream non-hardcore audience, if you want to call that, Brett wasn't cool. Sid certainly wasn't. Now they had an act that was cool and was going to take him into the future.
Indeed, I can think of no better way to end this than just the promos that we've seen, obviously from Austin built up, the great one from Brett. We've seen where it's going. We're starting to see that kind of shoot element, even with Brett and Sean on one side and Nash on the other. This is all stuff that sets up perfectly for us for the second quarter of 1997, and I cannot wait to get to that show because the shit is going to hit the fan and it's absolutely glorious when we get to it. One note I just want to mention for the WCW side, we mentioned there Sting and Hogan is the plan. One line that I absolutely love, and it just set it so perfectly in motion, Uncensored, when Sting and Hogan finally touch for the first time since this whole thing started. Sting drops Hogan and Heenan just screams, "He can beat Hogan!" And that's it. That's just perfect. It sets in motion where we're going to go. It tells the story. When are we going to get there? Pay to see it. It's really quite impressive that they actually stuck with it that long.
Yeah, and we've talked all about, you know, not faces not getting enough shine on the NWO. The positive to that side is when you actually build
something, one guy did,
and you hold it off, and then you give the promise that one guy can, then it's going to pay off for you. We'll get to that in due course, obviously.
We will get to it in due course, and it does raise the question of how much, if even at this point, if this much heat is too much heat. But we can end the show with no other song than the one that's going to play now. I want to thank everybody for listening. We will be back next week. So, for G. John Chase,
Loser.
For Carl Jones,
the last time anybody sweat this much, Vince was on trial and Apple was saying to the jury, not guilty.
And for Kieran O'Rourke,
last time I sweat this much, I was in Amsterdam with a bucket full of Euros.
I'm Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.
Never known another way, living out a dream.